All right, continuing our introduction to the historical books of the Old Testament, we have a little more material to cover. And to tell the truth, I'm going to be doing a lot of reading because this is, rather than talking off the cuff, because there's a lot of technical history here, I wanted to give you something of the historical setting of the surrounding world. You know, the historical books really deal with the nation of Israel. Geographically, a very small piece of property, about the size of Rhode Island, I think, and a very tiny country. At one point, it's only 6 miles across from one side to the other. Very tiny country. But almost all the significant action of the Bible takes place there. But obviously, because it is a tiny country and it's surrounded by bigger and important countries, the stories involve Israel's relations with these other countries around them. And so it's helpful to know something about what was going on in the world, especially in that part of the world that affected our stories that we're going to be reading about, besides what was going on in Israel. So that's what we want to talk about a little bit. The great empires of that region that conquered the world of their time and reigned for varying lengths of time each, begin actually with ancient Babylonia, but we don't have that on our notes because ancient Babylonia was earlier than the time we're looking at, in the days of Abraham. Babylonia or Mesopotamia was very significant. Hammurabi, the king of Babylon, left a monument that's very significant. The laws of Hammurabi are on display, I believe, in the British Museum, if I'm not mistaken. And very enlightened society in the time of Abraham. Abraham lived 2,000 years before Christ, and there have been whole libraries of Babylonian literature that have been discovered in Ur of the Chaldees, where Abraham originated. And that's 2,000 years before Christ. That was very important, by the way. It doesn't have anything to do with the books we'll be studying now, except insofar as, of course, the Jews we're reading about now, the Israelites, are descended from Abraham, and he came from ancient Babylonia. It was a very developed culture that he left, a very pagan culture, of course. This same ancient Babylonia eventually became the mighty Empire of Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. But that was much later. And before that time, between the time of Abraham and the time of Hezekiah, or not Hezekiah, more like Jehoiakim, when Nebuchadnezzar was making his conquest, other empires rose to be more powerful or more influential, at least in Israel, than Babylonia. One of those, of course, was Egypt. And Egypt played a major role in the books prior to these. That is, of course, the Exodus period in the time of Moses. Moses was born in Egypt. So were all the people who came out of Egypt, and a few of the ones who came out of Egypt and went into the Promised Land were born in Egypt. Egypt was the most powerful nation in the world up until about the time of the Exodus. We don't have complete records of that period, but we know that Egypt ceased to be very influential after that. And it might be because they lost about 3 million of their slaves all at once, and also all their agriculture and their livestock and their army, things like that. That would have a real, their pharaoh, that would have a real dampening effect on superpower status of a nation. And so Egypt was no longer at this period, when we come to Joshua's time, and the period we're looking at, Egypt was not that big or that significant. They were still bigger than Israel, and on rare occasions they come into the narrative as sort of a side issue. The Egyptian king Shishak, who we mentioned when we were talking about archaeological finds, he did invade Judah once in the reign of Rehoboam, according to 1 Kings chapter 14, verses 25 and 26. And we saw that the archaeologists have found Shishak's inscription that mentioned his invasion of that. So that's confirmed both biblically and archaeologically. Later kings of Judah sometimes were inclined to trust in Egypt as an ally when they should not. Hezekiah, for example, was strongly influenced that direction by certain counselors. This was when the Assyrians had come to major power, and they were threatening the whole region. The smaller nations like Israel and like Syria and like Judah at that time were very tempted to find large allies to help them resist the incursions of the Assyrian imperialism. And Hezekiah, for one thing, was significantly influenced toward trusting in Egypt for help against the Assyrians. But Isaiah the prophet gave him counsel that this would be displeasing to God for him to trust in Egypt, and he should just trust in the Lord. And it was because Hezekiah trusted the Lord instead of in Egypt that God sent that angel to kill those 185,000 Assyrians and to deliver Jerusalem. Even Rabshakeh, the general of the Assyrians who was besieging the city of Jerusalem, said to Hezekiah as he shouted at the walls of the city, said, "Don't trust in Egypt. That's like a leaning on a broken reed. It'll break and pierce your hand," you know. And he was pretty right. The Assyrians had assessed Egypt pretty well. Most of the people who trusted in Egypt for help didn't get any help from them. There's one other time significantly that Egypt figures into the historical books, and that's in the time of Josiah. Sadly, Josiah, who was a good king in general, ignored the counsel of a prophet who counseled him against doing so, and he went out to fight against Pharaoh Necho, one of the Egyptian pharaohs that was seeking to attack the Assyrians at Carchemish. And it was the defeat of the Egyptians at Carchemish that really made Assyria a world power, pretty much put Egypt out of the picture altogether. And for some reason, Josiah, we're not told exactly why, but Josiah did not want Egypt to conquer the Assyrians. And so he went out to fight against Pharaoh, Necho, and got himself killed. And sadly, a prophet actually told him not to do it, but he had, though otherwise a good king, that was his fatal error. Literally fatal for him. That battle of Carchemish and the death of Josiah, you can read about in 2 Chronicles 35. Now, another significant neighbor of Israel, though never rising to world power status, was Aram or Aram, who we would call Syria. I think in the New King James, which I'm using, the name Syria is retained because the King James uses the word Syria. But most scholars would speak of this nation as Aram. Aramaic, the language I mentioned that the Jews eventually were speaking, is named after Aram. Abraham sent his messenger to get a wife for Isaac from Paddan Aram, from this very region, from Syria. Syria was never a very large power, but because they flanked Israel on one side and were usually hostile to Israel, they were significant in a lot of the stories in the Bible. Usually as adversaries, they were actually the most important thing about Syria or Aram is the role they played in causing the Assyrians, an entirely different people, to become a world empire. The Assyrians, for many centuries, were not particularly expansionistic in their goals. They were willing to just be live and let live for the most part, but the Syrians, the people of Aram, actually would invade Assyria, not successfully usually, but enough to be like a gadfly to really irritate them. And after a few centuries, that the Assyrians just thought, we're tired of this. And so they invaded Syria and decided to take over the whole region and eventually became world power themselves, almost unintentionally. So the Syrians are not to be confused with the Assyrians. Syria is a small country adjacent to Israel. Its capital is Damascus. You may know that name because of, well, the Apostle Paul was on his way there to arrest Christians. He was on his way to Damascus. He was obviously traveling internationally to persecute Christians, and he met Jesus on the road there. But Damascus is important in the historical books because it's the capital of Aram. And Aram is important because they're troublesome. There was actually one time when Syria, or Aram, joined with the northern kingdom of Israel in a confederacy against Judah. This was because the Assyrians were now threatening them. And, it's like Syria had attacked Assyria one time too many, and now the Assyrians are striking back. And so Syria's terrified, and they try to get a coalition of small kingdoms together to fight off the Assyrians. They got the northern kingdom of Israel to agree to it, but they didn't get Ahaz and Judah to agree to it. But they decided to force his hand. So Israel and Syria decided to come together against Judah. And that was what was bothering King Ahaz at the time when Isaiah the prophet went to him and said, don't worry about this. These two kings of Syria and Israel, they'll be dead within 3 years or something like that. And it's on that occasion that God gave the sign, the virgin shall conceive and bring forth a son. He gave that as a prophecy to Ahaz on that occasion. But anyway, Syria should be recognized as essentially a small kingdom that was nonetheless big enough to be real trouble to Israel at certain times. I mean, Israel was a small kingdom too. So it was a significant enemy at times. And I believe the first nation to attack Israel in the book of Judges was Assyrian. That is not Assyrian, but it was Assyrian power came against him. Now, much more important than either Egypt or Syria would be Assyria. That was a nation further to the east and north of the Middle East, but they expanded, as I said, in response to trouble that Syria was giving them, and they eventually became the dominant power in the region. And of course, that they conquered the northern kingdom of Israel and ended it when they destroyed Samaria, which was the northern capital's capital, northern kingdom's capital. That was the end of the northern kingdom in 722 BC. So the Assyrians are significant in that they destroyed 10 tribes of the 12 tribes permanently. Then it was a later Assyrian who came down to Jerusalem and besieged it, Sennacherib, and that's the one who the angel of God killed a bunch of his soldiers and ended that. And so God spared Jerusalem at that time. At that time of Assyrian expansion, he did not spare the northern kingdom because they were given totally over to idols. But he did spare the southern kingdom at that time because Hezekiah was a godly king and prayed to the Lord. Later, the southern kingdom fell, considerably later, to the Babylonians. But in the Assyrian period, Judah survived. Tiglath-Pileser is mentioned in the Old Testament. He reigned the Assyrians from 1115 to 1076 BC. He made certain aggressive encroachments on neighboring territories, but his gains were not permanent. Okay, it was Ashurbanipal II and Shalmaneser III who, from 884 to 824 BC, expanded Assyria's borders to the Mediterranean, conquering Israel, but not Aram. So he didn't even. It was because of provocations from Aram that he actually attacked. He didn't actually defeat Aram at that time, but he did defeat Israel, which is even more significant to our story. Then Tiglath-Pileser III, very important, from 745 to 727 BC, adopted a strategy of conquest, deportation, and colonization, which expanded Assyria's control. His successor was Shalmaneser V, 727 to 722 BC. He's the one who conquered Israel's capital city, Samaria, and deported the population, ending the history of Israel as a separate kingdom from Judah. Sargon II is mentioned only in Isaiah 20 and verse 1. And little was known of him, but from 722 to 705, he was the next ruler of Assyria. He did carry on further campaigns in Palestine, according to Isaiah 20 and verse 1. The interesting thing about him is that he's an Assyrian ruler that for many centuries, critics of the Bible said he never existed. They knew about a Sargon the first, but scholars denied that there was a Sargon the second, and actually criticized the Bible on the basis of saying that Isaiah was wrong for mentioning him. This is something critics have done a number of times. They did the same thing with Belshazzar, and in both cases they came back with egg on their faces to a very large degree. Belshazzar, who was the last king of Babylon, scholars said for a long time he never existed because they couldn't find any evidence of it. Only the Bible mentioned him in Daniel chapter 5. But not surprisingly, eventually, archaeological confirmations about Belshazzar came up that confirmed what the Bible said. Same thing is true of Sargon II. For a long time, critics said there never was a Sargon II. The Bible's wrong. But then they did some excavations in his capital city and found his palace and his name all over it. And so no one doubts that there was a Sargon II now, that they... It's sort of the way things go with the critics. archaeology is not their friend. Archaeology is the friend of faith, because faith in the Bible will always put you ahead of science. The Bible tells you it's true before the scientists catch up, and or the archaeologists. But eventually they catch up. And if you ever hear critics saying, you know, Bethlehem was not occupied in the first century, and therefore Jesus couldn't have been born in Bethlehem, or archaeologists have never found any evidence of Nazareth existing in the first century, so Jesus could have been raised there, take it with a grain of salt. What they're saying is they have not yet found confirmation. They've said that about a lot of things in the Bible, and time again, they've been embarrassed. You'd think they would learn, but they're not of a mind to learn, apparently. But after Sargon II, Sennacherib is the one who besieged Jerusalem. He reigned in Assyria from 705 to 681 B.C. He established Nineveh as the capital of Assyria. Obviously, Nineveh is that city that Jonah prophesied against. It was a very pagan city, and it was 40 days away from destruction when Jonah arrived. At least, could have been. He said 40 days Nineveh is going to perish, but then the king of Nineveh, I'm not sure who the king was at the time of Jonah, but the king of Nineveh actually repented, and so did the city, and so Nineveh lasted another 100 years before they were destroyed by the Babylonians, or the Medes actually. But so Nineveh was established as the capital of Assyria by Sennacherib, and he staged an abortive siege of Jerusalem, which we've talked about already. He's the one who lost all those soldiers. Esarhaddon, another king from 681 to 669 B.C., subdued Egypt and declared himself to be the king of kings of Egypt. And 6 decades later, the empire ended when the Medes captured and totally destroyed Nineveh in 612 B.C. That's what would have happened 100 years earlier if they hadn't repented. Jonah had gone to them about 100 years earlier and preached that they were going to die in 40 days, but their repentance got them to last long enough to wipe out Egypt anyway. So they were succeeded actually by the Babylonian Empire. The Medes conquered Assyria, but they didn't set up a Median Empire at that point. The Babylonians rose to power more under Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was sort of the Alexander the Great of Babylon. Alexander, of course, was Greek, but and hadn't lived yet, but in the 6th century B.C., Nebuchadnezzar established Babylon as the queen of the nations, or queen of the cities of the world. The famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon and all the Babylonian culture that became so legendary was really Nebuchadnezzar's doing. Now, Babylonia, which is the same place, essentially, had been around for a long time, actually centuries and centuries, but had not risen to the kind of power in the intervening period that it did under Nebuchadnezzar. In the period of the Judges, which is when our story begins almost, Babylon was not expanding because it was in conflict with Assyria in that period of time. Now, Assyria at that time was not expanding toward Israel, but they were fighting with their border on the other side, Babylon. So Babylon did not expand much during the time of the early history books we're going to be studying here. Chaldean Babylonians came to power in Babylon in the 9th century B.C., and the empire that ensued, known as Chaldea, eventually displaced the Assyrian Empire in the reign of Nabopolassar, 626 to 605 B.C. Now, Nabopolassar actually invaded Jerusalem in 605 and took captives. Among the captives that were taken were Daniel and his three friends. Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were taken captive into Babylon in 605 by Nabopolassar. However, they were treated with great respect because of their gifts. They were very intelligent and gifted young men, and apparently handsome young men, and the Babylonians decided to train them in the culture and the language of the Babylonians and make use of them. But that was the first deportation of Jews from Babylon in 605. After that, Nebuchadnezzar II, from 605 to 562, is the one who defeated the Egyptians at Carchemish, but he did not annex Egypt. He defeated Egypt there, but he didn't go down and annex Egypt as part of his empire. He established Babylon as the mistress of the world. He destroyed Jerusalem in 586 BC and took most of the Jews into captivity, which is, of course, one of the great significant things in Israel's history, or Judah's history. The Babylonian exile and God's restoration of the Jews from that exile is said in the prophets to actually eclipse in importance the Exodus itself. Some of the prophets mentioned that when God would bring Israel out of exile, they would no longer say, "Blessed be Yahweh, the God of Israel, who brought them out of Egypt," but they would say, "Blessed be Yahweh, the God of Israel, who brought them out of all the lands to which they've been driven." So that it was like a second Exodus of sorts in its importance. The return of the Jews from Babylon and the, sort of like the earlier Exodus from Egypt were major, major events in Israel's history, and it was Nebuchadnezzar who took them into captivity. But he didn't reign for all that long, and there were a few successors he had, and then in the time of Nabonidus and Nabonidus' son Belshazzar, the Babylonian Empire fell to the Medes and the Persians, who had joined forces at this time. And the Persian Empire began, or the Media-Persian Empire, as it's sometimes called. Persia arose as a nation in the 7th century B.C., but was dominated by the Medes until 558 B.C. Then Cyrus the Great, who was a Persian, emerged as the conqueror who would bring about dynamic growth to the Persian Empire. Cyrus conquered Babylon in 536 B.C., making Persia the new world power. Cyrus issued a decree allowing foreign captives in the empire to return to their native lands, and that's why it's important for our story, because that was the occasion of the Jews being able to go back to build Jerusalem again. Only a small remnant of them chose to do so, but the fact that some did meant that Israel was back on the map, and Jewish history had some more chapters to it and didn't just end in Babylon. This led to the return of the Jewish exiles who rebuilt Jerusalem under Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. And later, being sponsored by the Persian king, Artaxerxes, that is, Nehemiah and Ezra were sent by Artaxerxes. Esther was married to a Persian king, the one previous to Artaxerxes, known as in scripture as Ahasuerus, but better known to us as Xerxes. He reigned in Persia from 486 to 465 B.C. That was Esther's husband. Now, that's pretty much the whole, you know, international scene around Israel during the whole period of the 1,000 years we're going to be looking at in historical books. There's also the religious environment, and it's certainly equally important because Israel was not just a nation of a political sort with a political history, but it's a nation whose whole origins and significance rested on its relationship with Yahweh, who was a jealous God. And he had a covenant with Israel, like a husband has with a wife. That's how he viewed it. At Mount Sinai, when Yahweh brought them out of Egypt, he made a covenant with them that he would be faithful to them if they'd be faithful to him. And this is in perpetuity. So this is like a wedding covenant. And God, afterward, the prophets would look back at that as the time when God married Israel. And she was seen as his wife. And just like a husband wants his wife to be sexually faithful to him, God wanted Israel to be faithful in terms of worshiping him alone. And when they didn't worship him alone, when they worshiped other gods, he described that as his wife committing adultery. Like a man would view a woman who he's married to committing adultery with other men, God viewed Israel's worshiping of idols to be like adultery. So we enter the story in the book of Joshua shortly after God has made this covenant with Israel, this exclusive covenant, like marriage. He made it 40 years before the beginning of Joshua. And Israel is at this time willing to obey, willing to be faithful. They've seen their parents die in the wilderness because they weren't faithful, and so they did follow Joshua faithfully enough in his lifetime. But after his death, many in Israel began to be sort of drift away from their faithfulness to God and to become curious and attracted to some of the pagan religions around them, most of which are mentioned from time to time in the Bible because Israel spent more of their history disobedient than obedient, I think we could say. We don't know exactly how much time in the book of Judges they were disobedient. We know how long they were obedient because they were obedient during the time that during the tenure of a judge. They served God while the judge lived till he died. That was usually 40 years or 80 years. But then they would go into disobedience, and we're never told how long that was. Never told how long they were disobedient before the next judge came along. But we do know that once the monarchy began, they were disobedient almost all the time. There are very few revivals of their faithfulness to Yahweh. Only a very few kings. When the kingdom split into two, the northern kingdom had 19 kings in a row. None of them were good. Every one of Israel, the northern kingdom's kings, worshipped idols and sponsored idolatry. So, like, the northern kingdom was continuously adulterous for hundreds of years. And then the southern kingdom had 20 kings, but almost all of them were bad. Judah's history was punctuated, though, by an occasional good king. Uzziah was a good king. Hezekiah was a good king. Josiah was a good king. There are very few others. But apart from maybe a handful of Judah's kings, the other ones were all just as bad as the ones up north. And so we find most of Israel's time is spent in rebellion against God. And eventually they come under judgment from God. But it's because of these religions around them. Now see, if America collapses, most historians will say it's because our economy, we made bad economic decisions, or, our military became too weak from being spread out with too many, military police forces in other countries where we shouldn't have been, or whatever. I mean, we spread our resources too thin. This is how historians will probably look back on the fall of America. You know, bad policies economically, bad military policies, bad, who knows what else, immigration policies. I'm sure that when America goes down, there'll be a lot of talk about what made it happen, and it won't probably be the right answers. The right answer will, of course, be that America has turned from God. Now, if we didn't have the Bible, that might also be the way Israel's history would be remembered. It's just another country that went down. You know, part of it went down to Assyria, part of it went down to Babylon, so did a lot of other countries. You know, they were militarily weak, or they were economically divided, or whatever. I mean, if we didn't have the Bible's interpretation of things, Israel's history and its demise would be interpreted the same as any secular country's word. But that's the difference. Israel was not a secular country. They were a country whose whole history existed because of God. And their relationship with God was absolutely defining of their existence. And it was because they turned from God that judgment came upon them and they were destroyed. So that's why we need to not only look at the political history around them, but the religious influences that eventually they succumbed to and brought an end to their existence. And so let's talk a little bit about the religious scene at the time. Basically, you probably know what monotheism is and what polytheism is. Monotheism is belief in one God. Israel was pretty much the only country in the world that we know of that was monotheistic. They had one God named Yahweh. We usually think of the option to that being polytheism. We think of maybe the Greek gods on Mount Olympus and the Roman gods, the Zeus and Hermes and all those different gods. We think of that, polytheism. There's something else that's between monotheism and polytheism. It's called henotheism, H-E-N-O, theism. H-E-N-O-T-H-E-I-S-M. Henotheism is sort of a mix of monotheism and polytheism. You say, how can you mix those two? There's either one or there's not one. In the ancient world, at least in Israel's time, the view of most cultures was that there are many gods, but each nation has only one. There were national gods. So, practically speaking, they were like monotheists. The Philistines worshipped Dagon, the Moabites worshipped Chemosh, and so forth. And so they each had their national god, but they acknowledged that the other gods, the other nations, were real gods too. So they were really polytheistic in their theology, but kind of monotheistic in their practice. That's how all nations pretty much were. Now, Israel was different from that in that they were monotheistic in theology, polytheistic in practice, because they really worshipped other gods that they didn't really believe in, I think. But the point is, each nation around Israel had its national deity. And Israel did, had Yahweh. Now, most of the nations around Israel believed in Yahweh. They just didn't worship Yahweh, because they had their own national deity to worship. They believed that Yahweh was Israel's national deity, and that he was a real God. But so was Chemosh, and so was Baal, and so was Molech, and so was Dagon. They considered that all these were real gods. It's just that they believed that the Jews were supposed to worship Yahweh, and other nations were supposed to worship other nations. I think Jeremiah is the one who at some point is puzzled over Israel worshiping other gods and says, search and inquire. It might have been Isaiah, I forget the passage exactly, but he says, has there ever been another nation that forsook its gods and adopted the gods of another nation, like Israel has done? And the answer is apparently no. None of the nations around them ever worshipped Yahweh or the other gods of the nations around them. They just worshipped their own God. Israel, the only nation that had the real God, couldn't stay with him. They wanted to borrow religions from other nations around them. And the irony is that they're the only ones whose God was actually real. And he proved it by judging them for that. But it was often the case, in fact, almost always the case, that in a war between two nations, the people saw it really as a war between two deities. If Israel was at war against, the Moabites, it was Yahweh against Chemosh, Or if it was against Babylon, it was Bel, the god of Babylon, that was defeating Yahweh. This is problematic, of course, because there were times when God actually wanted Israel to lose because he was judging them. And yet he knew that the nations around would interpret it like he was weak, because everyone knew Yahweh was Israel's God. And if he allowed an outside nation to defeat Israel, he knew it would be interpreted by everyone, oh, their God was stronger than Yahweh. But he took his chances anyway. In the book of Isaiah, he says to Israel, my name is blasphemed among the heathen because of you. And what he means is, because you're forcing me to judge you, people are going to misunderstand and think I'm weaker than their God. So I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to just take the hit. I'm going to take the hit on my reputation because I have to judge you. And so this is how things were understood in those days. Now, Israel may have been attracted to the gods of the pagans, partly because there were times when the pagans seemed to be prospering or powerful, and they felt like, oh, this means their God is better than our God. And it seems strange to us, as you read through the book of Judges or the book of Kings, you think, how can they keep making these same mistakes? I mean, it almost seems unreal. How can it be that their ancestors made this mistake every generation and they make the same mistake? Don't they learn anything from history? And apparently they don't. But before we're too hard on them, realize how hard it is for you to pass your faith on to your children and for them to really own it. It's easy to teach your children what you believe. It's not easy to impart it to them. You have an experience with God. You've been born again. You have there's a reality of God that's convincing to you. You can tell your children about it. But if they don't have that experience too, it's just unreal to them. And the next generation is even more unreal to them unless God sends a revival in their time. So, I mean, it's often the case that God moves in a mighty way in a certain generation, and there's a large number of people who really say, wow, God is real, and they get excited about God. We had a revival like that back in the 70s, 60s and 70s, the Jesus movement, and a whole bunch of people got harvested into the kingdom of God and had dynamic experiences with Christ, and they'll never have any doubts that God is real. The baby boomers, of which many of us are them. Most of us are them. And many of us have children who we thought they'd believe like we did. We taught them how. We taught them the truth. We even modeled it for them as best we could. But then we looked and said, how come this isn't real to them? Every generation has to have their own connection with God. And a generation whose parents were Christian has an advantage in that they know from an early age who they have to connect with. I always told my children, you know, I can and I must, I'm responsible to make you know what the truth is, but I can't make you care about it. I can only make you know about it. I can't make you care. I wish I could. You know, I wish I could just get inside your heart and engineer something there so that you care about it like I do. But that just, we know from experience that's not always the case. Now, some of you have children who are serving God. God bless you. We have more power to you. But I think a lot of us, I see the heads nod like there's a lot of people who understand what I'm talking about. So we shouldn't be too surprised when the Israelites, you know, one generation sees a great deliverance from God in through one of the judges or something like that, or through Josiah's revival or reforms or whatever. And then the next generation, they don't care anything about it. To them, God's just something they've heard about. And they're not so sure they like. To him, I mean, they're like kids who say, well, why is Jesus so special? I mean, there's a bunch of Hindus over there. They seem to be good people, too. And what about these Buddhists? They're good folks. Don't they say a lot of the same things we Christians say? And the kids, they think, well, why do we have to be Christians when there's these other religions out here and these people are good people, too? How do we know we're right? I'm sure the Israelites had that same problem with their kids, the generation that didn't see the deliverance from God. They just heard about it. And when you got even another generation beyond that, it's just getting to be a faint, you know, story they've heard from their grandparents. But they're seeing other guys say, well, maybe, and you know what? It was a lot easier for the flesh to accept the religions of the pagans around than to accept the religion of Yahweh. Because Yahweh demanded holiness of life, and it kind of goes against human nature to live a holy life. It's really hard to live a holy life. But the nations around them, their worship services were orgies, drunken orgies. They didn't have any morality. They were bloodthirsty, warlike nations that were driven by sex and by cravings of the flesh. I mean, their deities were custom made to approve and to endorse the kind of behavior that the most carnal side of man wants to live. So, you know, these kids who, to them, Yahweh was just a rumor to them. And not a very fun one either, you know. But the nations around them, the people they're seeing around there, you know, they're having orgies. Hey, their gods like that. That sounds like an attractive thing. Probably more to men than to women. But there were other aspects, the drunkenness and the other stuff that really drew people off. And then they also had beliefs. See, most of the gods of the heathen were fertility deities. And it was an agrarian society. It was really important to have a lot of kids to help you on the farm, and it was really important to have crops grow because your whole prosperity was attached to the land and its productivity. And almost all of the gods of the heathen were fertility gods. And so doing these rites, sacrificing a baby to Moloch, you know, that was like to enhance your fertility. Seems like it's going the opposite direction in that case, but that's what they thought. And they thought that would give you good crops and things like that. So, you know, if Israel was having a bad year agriculturally and the Ammonites were, you know, had good crops, that made the average Israelite look and say, but maybe their God is, maybe it's working out for them better to worship that God than us worshiping Yahweh. And there are expressions of that sentiment in places like Psalm 73 or Malachi chapter 3 or a few other places in the scripture. In some of the prophets and the Psalms, where the expression is given to, like, what profit is it to us to worship Yahweh? You know, things are going badly for us. You know, we don't have much money, our crops are failing, and here we're being faithful to Yahweh. Maybe we should worship other gods. Maybe it's not profitable to worship Yahweh. This is not something the prophets advocated or the psalmist, but it's things they were hearing. Malachi rebuked that very attitude in Psalm 73. The psalmist said, I almost succumbed to that idea. That's that song we sung, Truly God is Good to Israel. It says, as for my feet were almost gone, my steps had almost slipped. If you read on further in that psalm, it says, because I beheld that the wicked were prospering. And I'm a good guy and I'm not prospering. And I think, you know, what good is it to serve God? And so sometimes other religions, you know, if people were worshiping Yahweh faithfully and things weren't going well for them, they thought, well, maybe one of these other gods will do better for me. And so people were drawn after the wrong gods. And here's the gods that were around them. Dagon. Now the Philistines were never in the early days driven out of the land. In the days of Joshua and the Israelites conquered essentially all the land of Canaan. They didn't wipe out all the individual cities. Some cities still remained to defy them. Even Jerusalem for a while did, until David's time. But they nonetheless secured the borders. But they never secured the coastal strip on the Mediterranean, which was controlled by five Philistine cities. The Philistines were very warlike, strong people. They had a number of giants among them, like Samson. The Anakim, who were also giants, also were living in one of the Philistine cities. They were trouble. And their religion was the worship of Dagon. Now, Dagon, scholars once thought the name meant fish god. When I was growing up, the commentaries were saying that Dagon was a god who had a body like a man and a head of a fish. Because the word Dagon in Hebrew, it looked like it was connected to the word for fish. Scholars are not so sure that that's its meaning now, and I don't think they've found any statues of a fish god, so there are some doubts as to whether Dagon was really a fish god or not. In any case, he was the god of the Philistines. They think now he might have been a grain god, like most of the gods around. He was worshipped throughout the Fertile Crescent, not just by the Philistines, but throughout the Middle East there. And in the period of the historical books, Dagon was the god of the Philistines primarily. Samson destroyed the temple of Dagon when he died, when he pulled down the pillars of that temple as the temple of Dagon. And there were, 3,000 the worshippers of Dagon there that died with Samson on that occasion. But Samson did not rid the Israel of the Philistines. The Philistines were oppressive people, gave Israel a lot of trouble until really David defeated them. David's the one who got rid of them for the most part, brought them into subjection to Israel. At one point before David's time, the Ark of the Covenant was captured by the Philistines and put in the Temple of Dagon. It's kind of a funny story in a way in 1 Samuel that they put the Ark, it was like a trophy of battle against Israel. The Philistines captured the Ark. They put it in the Temple of Dagon, and the next day the statue of Dagon had fallen down on its face prostrate. At my age, prostate's more on my mind. But the statue had fallen prostrate on its face before the Ark of the Covenant. And so he set it back up again and went away again. And the next day they came back, it was falling down again, and its head and its hands were cut off. Who did that? It was never explained. But they decided that the Ark was not, that was not a good place for the Ark. It's not good for Dagon to have Yahweh in his presence. So eventually they took the Ark from city to city, and every place it went, the bubonic plague and rats infested the place, so they finally sent it back to the Israelites. And so we're going to see some Dagon stories in the Bible. Baal, of course, is a very common term in the Old Testament. Worshipping Baal, actually the term Baal sometimes is in the plural, Baals. Baal could have been a more or less generic term for any number of pagan gods, though there seems to be one specific deity called Baal. The word Baal means master or lord or husband. And so obviously any nation might refer to their god as their Baal. But there is a specific Baal that seems to be the god of the Canaanites. He's depicted as the son of El, who is the nebulous supreme deity. So there's kind of a supreme deity in their thinking named El, but no one has any contact with him or worships him. But Baal is the one god that relates with the Canaanite people as their deity. Baal is a generic identification of various regional nature deities responsible for agriculture and the fertility of livestock. In some contexts, he is said to be the son of Dagon. Worship of Baal involved immoral sexual rites, as have been documented by archaeological discoveries quite a bit. They have found much evidence of the orgies and so forth that were part of Baal worship, as well as the worship of most of these other gods. Then you have a feminine name, Asherah, or Ashtoreth. Now, scholars are not in agreement as to whether Asherah and Ashtoreth are the same or two different goddesses. Both of them, in some archaeological finds, are associated with Baal as his consort. So a lot of the pagans saw Baal as a god who had a female consort, who is a goddess. Asherah and Ashtoreth are both depicted this way. It seems like most scholars, they think that they're not the same goddess, but some still think they are. Ashtoreth is called the goddess of the Sidonians. Sidon was up north of Israel, in what we call Phoenicia. Isn't that Lebanon today, I think? And that they worshipped Ashtoreth. It says in 1 Kings 11:5, it's not clear whether Asherah and Ashtoreth are identified or regarded as two separate goddesses, though scholars incline toward the latter view. Both are regarded as the consorts of Baal. Asherah poles were erected next to the altars of Baal in Judges 6:25. These poles were carved of wood and described as obscene in 1 Kings 15:13. Not to be too graphic, but Asherah poles were, at least from what I've read, actual carved images of male sex organs. These pagan gods were all very sexually oriented. Of course, they're fertility deities, you know, so obviously sex is associated with fertility, and so it's, you know, the confused pagans, you know, they kind of mix these things up a lot, but a lot of the statues and so forth that have been found are very sexually graphic. They're frequently mentioned in the same context with prostitution and sodomy in the Bible. The name Ashtoreth is derived from Astarte, the Phoenician goddess of love and of fertility and war, too. She is also identified with Venus, Aphrodite, and Diana in the classical world. Usually this goddess is depicted by statuettes as a nude woman. Her worship involved lewd sexual cult rituals. Now Molech, who's also in the Bible called Milcom, is the abomination of the Ammonites, according to 1 Kings 11:5. The Ammonites were cousins to Israelites of sorts. Ammon and Moab were the two sons of Lot. And Lot was, of course, the nephew of Abraham. So there's some family connection if you go back far enough. All the way back to Terah, really, is where you find a connection. But in general, the Ammonites and the Moabites were considered to be brother nations to Israel of sorts. God wouldn't let Israel invade them and conquer them when they came out of Egypt because of the relationship they had. But they were worshippers of Ammon, the Ammonites were. He was a fire god commonly worshipped throughout the ancient Near East and North Africa by Canaanites and Philistines, Arameans, and Semitic peoples, and later Phoenicians. Represented as a human figure with the head of a bull, it is thought that a bronze statue had a fire built within it, a statue of Molech, to turn it red hot. The practice of sacrificing children in the arms of this statue, it was called in scripture causing one's son or daughter to pass through the fire. You'll find that expression a lot in the historical books because some of the Israelites worship Molech and they pass their children through the fire, which means they burn them alive to this demon god. Even Manasseh, the king of in Jerusalem, did the same thing. He burned his son to Molech. Then Chemosh, I mentioned earlier, he's the abomination of the Moabites in 1 Kings 11:7. Chemosh was a god associated with the Semitic mother goddess Ashtar. Like Molech, the worship of Chemosh involved the sacrifice of children based upon Judges 11, 12, and 24. Some scholars believe Chemosh is the same god as Molech. Obviously, the chief god of the Moabites and the chief god of the Ammonites might be confused since those two nations were very closely associated and related to each other, though it is argued contrary by some. So these are the main gods and goddesses that you're going to hear about as we read through these books. Okay? Almost done. This last part, I want to say, is just my own observation. I've never heard anyone make these observations, but I've been unable to avoid making them myself as I've studied the Bible. It does seem that as you read through the history of Israel, there is some measure of correspondence with the history of the church in certain ways. For example, Israel was founded by Moses. Moses is a type of Christ. Of course, there's other types of Christ. Joshua himself is a type of Christ, too. But nonetheless, Moses is the most important founding figure in Israel's history, just as Christ is in ours. Moses gave the law. Jesus laid down the kingdom of God and its principles. And all Israel forever after Moses was to follow Moses' lead in this, following the law of Moses. All Christians are to follow Christ's authority and his teaching. So, the people speaking to the man who was born blind, the chief priest said, "You are his disciple," meaning Jesus. "We are Moses' disciples." Moses was to the Jews what Christ is to the Christians, really. And so the books of Moses, the Pentateuch, sort of corresponds in principle to the time when Jesus was here. When Moses was here governing Israel directly, it's sort of like when Jesus was here founding and governing the early church. But then Joshua, the book of Joshua is about the time of his leadership. After Moses was no longer there, Joshua took over the lead. He was directly appointed by Moses, by the laying on of hands, to be his successor. Jesus directly appointed the apostles. And Joshua sort of corresponds with the time of the apostles. Because basically Moses had the commission, and Joshua fulfilled the commission of taking the armies of Israel to conquer the land. The Israelites had the commission to go take the gospel to the world, and they did. The apostles did it. Jesus founded things, and the apostles took his message out and made the conquests of the whole Mediterranean world to become essentially a place where Christianity had a presence and eventually dominated. So it's like the period of Moses is like the period of Christ himself on earth. The period of Joshua is a lot like the period of the apostles, because Joshua is directly appointed to be the successor to Moses, but not with all the authority Moses had. In Numbers, it says that God told Moses to lay his hands on Joshua and put some of the authority that Moses had on him. The apostles don't really take the place of lordship that Jesus had, but they certainly had more authority than anyone since then has had in the church. They set norms for the church too, and they distributed, as it were, the inheritance to the church that Christ had left for us. And Joshua actually had some of the same kind of miracles happen through him that Moses did. The apostles also had the miracles of Jesus continuing. Now, I realize there's been miracles since then, but there have been no one since the apostles who've done really quite as many miracles as they did, it would appear. A few people, maybe. There might be a few people out there in Africa and China and stuff who've seen as many miracles, but in general, you don't find the leadership of the church worldwide doing as many miracles as the leadership of the church did during the time of the apostles. And Joshua's miracles were like those of Moses. The apostles' miracles were like those of Christ, and they were the successors to Christ. But then you have the period of the judges, which is rather an interesting time. I've been fascinated with the period of the judges because it represents the way God left things when Joshua was no longer there. It's interesting that Moses appointed Joshua to be his successor, but Joshua appointed no one to be his. When Joshua is gone, there's a vacuum. There's no leadership, no official leadership. How were the people supposed to be governed? Well, it says in Joshua there was no king in Israel in those days, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Well, that sounds like a bad thing. Unless, of course, they're governed by the law of God, then it's not a bad thing. In other words, Israel was left with God's law to follow, and each person was independent. There was no central government. There was no institutionalization. God would raise up leaders periodically, just charismatic guys who would lead Israel to a revival and to a victory and then serve them in his life, and then he died. There'd be no successor to the guy. It's like they didn't have any succession. It's just when God needed a man, he raised up somebody, he gifted somebody, and there's this charismatic leader to come up. He'd do great things for the church, and then he'd die, and there was no one there to replace him until it was needed again. And what's interesting is almost all people think that the period of judges was really a bad deal. But actually, the period of judges is what God set up. It's the people that changed it. The people didn't want to have that arrangement. They said, "Give us a king like all the nations have." And the thing displeased Samuel, and it displeased God that they wanted a king. God seemed to like it the way it was. Why? Because he was their king. Everyone answered to God directly. Some didn't do so very well, as the book of Judges shows. But God still wanted people not to be governed by a human figure. After Joshua is gone, there's no human figures that God appointed to rule the nation. They were supposed to obey God. There was a large degree of personal independence under God and personal accountability to God. But no institutionalization. But then the monarchy comes, which God didn't like, and that's kind of what happened to the church in the 4th century. The church got institutionalized. Even before that, it started to go that way, where they started having church officers that were appointed for political reasons, and they were succeeded by some kind of a, each church constitution would have some manner of succession. You know, when these elders die, then these ones take their place and so forth, and that's how denominations do it. That's how the Roman Catholic Church did it. Basically, what I call an institutional church is one that's organized in such a way that its leadership is succeeded automatically. And what happened, of course, when you have the monarchy, is it was no longer that Israel was led by people gifted by God, but people who were just the successors of the previous guy. They might be good people or bad people, and they're usually bad people. Same thing with the church in the institutional period. And the splitting of the nation in Rehoboam sort of reminds me of the Reformation, although it didn't bring about really a solution to the problem either, because both were institutionalized. Protestant churches and Catholic churches are institutionalized. So it's like the monarchy, up through the monarchy, we see sort of some parallels to what's happened in the church. And then you've got the Babylonian captivity. I don't know what that corresponds to, or the return. Maybe that's something that's yet future. Maybe there's a great falling away coming and a restoration. I'm not sure. But I just thought, I couldn't help but notice those similarities as we go through the Old Testament history, how that there are parallels to the way the church history has gone, which it's just surprising to me that I've never noticed that in any books on the subject. It's just, as I reflect on it, I thought, the monarchy, everyone seems to think the monarchy was a good thing because then people weren't just doing what was right in their own eyes. The problem is when you've got a monarch, people have to do what's right in a king's eyes, and he might be bad. It's much better to have God as your king, and then you're accountable. You do what's right in your own eyes, and you may please God or not, but at least you're answerable to God. And when you've got a king who's a tyrant, like Ahab and his wife Jezebel, you can't serve Yahweh because they'll kill you. You know, there's no freedom to serve God once it's institutionalized. So we're going to see some lessons as we go through the historical books in these different periods that will, I think, have quite natural parallels to things that apply to the church, of which we're a part, of course. And we'll see that as we go through these books. Tomorrow we're going to have an introduction to Joshua. Then we'll actually get into Joshua eventually here. But in the meantime, we're going to have to stop there.